Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of July. This hour of the program, the story came to us at the end of June. Even though it's too early for Tennessee to actually offer, the University of Tennessee has received its first commitment for the class of 2013. Evan Berry, the brother of University of Tennessee All-American safety Eric Berry, has committed to the university even before beginning his freshman season in high school. "It's the only college I know right now, and it seems the best for me," he said. "And my dad went there. My brother is there now. I know I can do the same things there. I have a really friendly relationship with the coaches. I don't know them too well, but I know that I will have plenty of time to get to know them." There are a number of young people who are setting their sights on certain kinds of schools. There are a number of schools showing an avid interest in young athletes, some as young as in sixth grade, not only football, but basketball and baseball as well. And we're going to be talking about all of that this hour of the program. And the number of people who go to camps, who try to train for college careers as athletes or try to train for careers that go beyond college. Our guest this hour is Dr. Daniel Frankel. He's a professor of kinesiology and nutritional science at California State University in Los Angeles. He has elementary and secondary physical education teaching credentials. He served as a combat fitness instructor and officer at the IDF's Combat Fitness Center. He has professional training in physical education, a BA in physical education from State University of New York, Brockport, and a master's from SIU in Carbondale. And he taught physical education at the college level at the University of Southern California. He was trained in sociology and psychology of physical education and sport, and holds gymnastics and track and field coaching certificates. We'll be welcoming phone calls about, how young is too young for children to be recruited by major institutions? And what about this whole philosophy that we have in this country of sending young people to camps to get on an early track, a very early track for careers in sports or scholarships in sports? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Frankel, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi. These stories pop out every now and then. The latest
just for the record, yeah. I also earned my PhD degree at Southern University at SIU.
Okay.
I have a PhD in sports psychology and social psychology of sports.
Sports psychology and social psychology of sports. Great. We hear these stories every now and then of young people, but this one really is striking to us. 13 years old. How can you know if you're going to be a college football player at 13? Is it indicative of a larger problem that we have younger and younger kids who are committing to universities or who are being scouted by universities, who are being trained by professional athletes to have this career that's a long way off?
There are two questions here. The first question is, as you said, how can we predict one's performance from early performance? And motor learning research tells us that predictions are not very good, because what kids do very well at the kids' level does not translate necessarily and directly to the professional level.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody is really good at something in elementary school, it has very little to do with what it takes to be good at the professional level. And we have many examples of some great athletes who had multi-million dollar offers and actually got into the professional sports and ended up not doing too well,
mm-hmm.
not being very successful. I mean, I can think of somebody like Danny Manning, or somebody like Herschel Walker. So it doesn't necessarily always translate that way, but definitely from the research we know it doesn't work. So that's the first part of the question. Then the second part of the question is this a good idea? And here, there are some moral issues, some moral questions, because what happens is that it takes thousands and thousands of hours of training to make the leap from a neophyte to a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the hours that are taken away from a child when they need to prepare for life. And the, we know that our text and the information that a child needs to learn in school has grown exponentially over the past, say, 20, 30 years. And these are hours taken away from a lot of kids that come from backgrounds that don't give them the access and the help and the support to get up front with their academics. And we're taking them away, and they're spending all of these tens of thousands of hours, at least 10,000 hours, in order to make this, the jump from one place to the other. And there is a big, huge moral question. Should we really make that investment in large numbers with large kids and just bring everybody in and then leave out their academics?
Mm-hmm. So who's behind this? Is it parents who are envisioning their sons and daughters to be professional athletes or to get full rides at schools?
Well, I think that parents definitely are part of the problem. But parents are consumers of the kind of information that the media is setting out there, the kind of information that the coaches are leaving out there, the kind of information that they see happening. All we hear about are the success stories. We hear about the articulate athletes. They are the ones who are being interviewed. We are hearing about the success stories of athletes that made it. We never hear about the stories about the athletes that did not make it, or the athletes that came in and were there for a month or two or 3 months and got injured or didn't make it and were cut out, were sent down to the minors or what have you. We never hear about these stories. So the impression is that anyone who is good and who is trying very hard and puts his or her heart to it will be able to make it.
Right.
But the statistics are that out of a million kids, only six will actually make it up.
No.
1 million kids that are getting on this track, only six will make it. You have a better chance to win the lottery.
Right. Of a million kids, only six will what, make it to a professional level?
That's right.
Oh, you need to keep saying that over and over. That's an incredible statistic.
I mean, if you look at the many, many thousands of kids that are very good football players, only one in 15,000 will make it in.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the kids that are incredibly strong tennis players, for example, you have, say, 200 best tennis players in the world right now, ranked 1 to 200.
Mm-hmm.
Out of these, you will have maybe 5 or 6 or 7 retiring. And then there are going to be thousands of players that can step in into their shoes and fill in, and they're still, we're not going to be among the 20 best or the 50 best that actually make money.
Right.
So you can be 200 and you can barely pay your expenses to just fly around and pay for a coach and pay for hotels and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So the getting in there, And playing in college, for example, play tennis in college, you're looking at a serve that is 30 miles an hour slower than the serve of the professionals. So the people like, it's amazing that people like, say, Pete Sampras or Andy Roddick actually made it and were able to go straight from high school into professionals and actually could play at that level and could do well, or Michael Chang, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the success stories. So just imagine how many failures are there out there.
Right, yeah.
And these are examples of young men who just went straight to the pros from high school, never went to college.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the number of camps that are springing up all over the country and the number of people who are going to professional coaches at a very young age, are we making a lot out of a molehill here, or are there increasing numbers of very young kids trying to engage the services of professionals and going to camps that are grooming them for college scholarships they may not receive, or life in the professional sports world, which they really may not receive?
Now, let me share with you a little story here. and of course with our audience. When my kids were very young, I took him to the, like all parents, I took him to a Space Jam, I think, and that was the movie. It's a movie with cartoons and with some actual players. And Michael Jordan was in one scene in that movie at the age of 7. He was shooting hoops, shooting baskets at midnight. And his father comes out and he says, "Michael, it's midnight. You have to go to school tomorrow." And Michael looks at his dad. He's 7 years old. And he says, "Here, Dad, one last shot for the University of North Carolina," whatever. He wanted to get into that program. And I think everybody in the movie theater kind of like sighed and just looked and said, "Ah, how sweet." I almost fell out of my chair. Because as a sports sociologist, I'm sitting in there and I'm thinking, I mean, this is the most idiotic thing. For a 7-year-old to say that, fine. But for no adult to come and say, to get to the university, you need to go to the library, not shoot
right.
at midnight.
Exactly.
But this is the kind of mentality that all the parents, unfortunately, a large number of parents have. And it's no longer 7 years old. When I started my it's a nonprofit free website, kidsfirstsoccer.com. Many years ago, out of frustration of seeing what was going on in the soccer leagues, I would get emails and questions from parents, "Where can I get my 8-year-old into a program? Where can I get my 7-year-old into a program?" Believe it or not, over the past 3 years, I have gotten several emails, parents asking, "Where can I get my 14-month-old, my 18-month-old into a program?" I mean, we're not even talking about years. We're talking about months.
Oh, no.
I mean, it is so absurd. And I already have standard letters that I have wrote, like letter articles, which I'm just pasting and sending it away because it has become so frequent that it will get. I mean, 3 and 4, we already have leagues for 3 and 4 playing soccer. Now, mind you, that to play soccer, you need to stand and balance on one foot, and you need to manipulate the ball with the other foot. And then you have some other people in your way. 3-year-olds that can barely stand.
Right.
So it's ridiculous, but the parents are getting panicked because they see the success of some. Some 3-year-olds actually can do it. And some 5-year-olds can actually be pretty good for a 5-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So the parents are looking and saying, "Well, if Johnny can do it, then if my son is not going to start, by the time my son is going to start, it's going to be too late."
Too late for what? What do they want?
Well, too late to get on this wagon of the rush to the gold, of the rush to the scholarship. But it really doesn't work quite that way. The chances are very, very low for it to be successful. But who's going to stop anybody and say that you don't have the chance of doing it? It's because everybody has the right to hope. It's just that we are not putting a little bit of a grain of salt on that hope. That's the problem. And there is not enough information. There is a lot of misinformation that is built into this hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing is, why choose the athletic route? Why not, as you suggested earlier, be sending them to the library and sign up for great summer reader programs instead of spending an incredible amount of money to be coached by some football player or tennis player somewhere? Why the emphasis on sports?
Well, the emphasis on sports is because the level of sports has well surpassed the level of academics. And I'm originally from Israel. I grew up in Israel and come from a small country that had some decent athletes, but Israel has never done very well internationally. So now, when you come from that perspective and you come to the United States, you see certain things that most people here are unaware of. And I'll give you examples. I went to Southern Illinois University, SIU. Most people haven't even heard of that university yet. Here, because, I mean, they don't have the visibility of USC or UCLA or Berkeley, University of Nebraska. They don't have the kind of visibility, University of Florida. They are not powerhouses in sports.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the basketball team at SIU, Southern Illinois University, in the early 80s, played the national Greek team, which is a decent team, I know, because they used to play Israel, and beat them. They played the national Turkish team, and they beat them. The national Russian team came to the United States for a tour maybe 25, 30 years ago, and they were beaten by 5 out of the 10 colleges that they played against. Now, this is a country of 200 million or whatever, 300 million playing against a college and losing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians were the most dreaded team in all of the European and Asian continent. So the level of athletics here in the United States is just so high that everybody feels panicked to be able to play at that level, let's start from the crib, to be able to make it. It's not amateur by any stretch of imagination. I cannot even see how it can be amateur if Southern Illinois University, every record on the track and field records at Southern Illinois SIU was significantly better than the national record of the track and field records in Israel.
I know. That's astounding.
In the shot put, in the long jump, in the high jump, in the sprints, in the anything. And we're not even talking about Colorado or UCLA or USC. These guys go straight out into the gold medal ranks. So the level of athletics in the United States is Nobel Prize level. And this is why there is this incredible rush to try and make it. And that, I see, is hurting academics, is hurting the whole system. Because it is so good, because it is so entertaining, because it is so professional, it is great to watch, and it becomes a big business. And now you have this additional aspect that gets into this whole deal, and it becomes very, it's already outside of the hands of the academics. The salaries that the coaches are making,
unbelievably high. You're right.
I mean,
yeah.
If I'm not wrong, I mean I may be wrong in this one, but I think it was in one of the Bible Belt universities, the coach was making $4 million a year. And the state budget for remedial education was less than that. The whole state's budget. I think it's in Kentucky, if I'm not sure. I don't want people calling me and telling me that I'm wrong. But something just to give you an idea, just to give you an idea. So the university president will make $250,000, $300,000 a year, and the coach will make $1.5 million in salary, and then the radio talk show and this, and we will end up making $4 million.
Yeah, go figure. Let's welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them. Professor Daniel Frankel is our guest, professor in the School of Kinesiology and Nutritional Science at California State University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He is the author. He was mentioning a website of numerous websites, two of which kinesiology majors may find useful, the Kids First Soccer site, Kids ForSoccer.com, which he talked about. And I think this one is still, we'll have to ask him if it's still around, Computer Terms site, which is a resource to novice computer users. At any rate, that Kids First Soccer, dedicated to a child-centered approach to the organization and administration of youth sports. All right, to your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Let's start with Mitch from Madison. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Very good. One thing we need to look at with this 13-year-old kid from Tennessee is that the NCAA doesn't even allow football teams to offer anything official in terms of scholarship offers to kids until I think their junior year. So take it with a grain of salt. It's more of a publicity stunt for Lane Kiffin to bring attention to his team. There's lots of things that are going to happen between this kid now and then. I mean, if he gets hurt, if he blows his knee out, that offer's not going to be there. If Lane Kiffin gets fired, the offer's not going to be there. I mean, it's really just kind of a thing to say, hey, look at what we're doing. Aren't we neat?
Mm-hmm.
As far as the college coaches' salaries and the competitiveness, I guess I would rather have kids be more competitive than not competitive. I'm kind of an old school guy where I say anything that gets these kids attention and away from the TV and the PlayStation and doing something with their friends and a, you know, a team effort, that's got to be better for them. I mean, granted, we'd all like the kids, you know, studying in the library more than anything, but anything's better than nothing. And these parents, I think, are going a little overboard. I see 12-year-olds with $500 baseball bats. You know, they're 12. They're not going to hit a 300-footer no matter
right.
what you give them.
Exactly. Professor Frankel.
Yeah, I think the caller is absolutely right about the publicity stunt. Because it is totally nonsensical that somebody gets a contract to get to university before they're even eligible to be a student at that university. Because, as we all know, the term is student-athlete, not athlete-student.
Mm-hmm.
So he's absolutely right in that sense, that this doesn't work. And this is not the first time, by the way. This is not the first contract. I think this is the one that probably made the news more than others. And we have lots of examples of such stunts, but the salaries of the coaches are so high because it's now controlled by the media and controlled by the businesses. It's no longer in the hands of the academics. For example, college football started as a purely a volunteer activity by the students, for the students. There was absolutely no involvement of the administration in it when it started in the, say, mid-19th century. And due to some bad injuries, the administration started getting involved, and also because there was a lot of interest from the public. So the administration started getting involved and slowly took over the operation, and then started hiring coaches and paying coaches. But now we see that this is becoming a business. But it's a business. How can a non-profit organization like college football have a coach that makes $1.5 million or whatever a year? This makes no sense. If this is non-profit, all they do is about profit.
Yeah, oh, sure it is.
I mean, every T-shirt and every pencil and every notebook has USC football on it or whatever, UCLA football on it, and you pay money to the program for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big business. And quite frankly, from my perspective, I have no problem with college athletes having the best coaches. I have a problem with calling it a non-profit. It should be for profit. It should be run as a profit, and should be run completely outside of the university program. Should be run something as a parallel program, because this is what it is.
Yeah.
And the basketball and the football programs, and then they can do. But now, is it much better than, for example, playing Nintendo? Football. This is another comment. Football is a sport that has enormous amounts of very bad injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of deaths every year that result out of football. And I cannot see how we would have tolerated it in any other sport except for football, when we had broken necks and deaths in gymnastics or in trampolining, and much fewer, it was thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is just my speculation. I figure insurance company executives like football, but they're not necessarily like gymnastics. So they are willing to take the risk for football, but not willing to take the risk for gymnastics or trampolining.
Hmm.
This is just my bias.
Hmm.
So this is how football survives, and these other sports are being kicked out and being eliminated.
Let's go to another caller. Mitch, thank you so much for your phone call. We go to Father Seth from Green Bay.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had the good fortune of being a professional baseball player in my early life. I was drafted by the Houston Astros. I also have a master's degree in divinity and postgraduate work. I'm a little league coach. Our family's always been involved in athletics. And just wanted to make a couple comments. First of all, I do agree with your caller. I do see a number of parents and trying to buy talent for their children. My experience over time has been that, you know, a child athlete or any athlete is a gifted, talented person, and you just can't produce it. You can improve skills, but at a certain level, you know, a child is going to mature into an athlete of world-class caliber if they've got the talent. And that can't be produced no matter how many programs you buy or how many coaches you buy. The other thing is, though, I worry about people looking at sports as somehow not on par with other arts or academics. I think sport in and of itself is something that's tremendously beautiful to watch, and it should be valued. Our school system here, my son's in fifth grade, going into fourth grade, rather, they have a half an hour of gym twice a week.
Yeah, that's not good.
And we live in a society where we're dealing with obesity on huge proportions. And also, I just wanted to mention the tremendous value that there comes from teamwork, goal setting, everything else, things that I learned in sports that propelled me academically, that I really don't think I would have gotten in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the financial end of things, you know, if universities are making all of this money and investing in it, those monies don't just go for the programs. They support the entire school system. And I think it's unfortunate that, you know, baseball players make $35 million a year. But that's the way economics has worked. And it's something that I think we either have to live with. But I think people have to take responsibility for where they're going to invest their time and their money and what kind of pressure they put on their children to do something that perhaps they can't. But if we were talking about children that had IQs that were huge or could play the violin like Mozart, the piano, we certainly would invest in them as children and we would hold them up as geniuses. I think the same thing should apply to sports.
Professor Frankel.
Well, it seems like we're muddying a little bit the water here because I have no problem with the marketplace deciding what are the salaries of baseball players or football players. And if they get $120 million or $35 million or $18 million, and this is the marketplace and this is what they get, I have no problem with that at all. I think that this is right. That's the way it should be. Why should a film star get $20 million for one movie? Because there is a market for that. But we are talking about college. We're talking about nonprofit institutions. So my issue is with the calling of a nonprofit institution nonprofit when it is for profit for itself. And if they are losing and they're not making money, then the taxpayer is paying the difference. Student fees and the taxpayers of the state are paying the differences. The point that a football program or a basketball program is bringing in money for the university is incorrect. It is not bringing in money for the university. The football stadium, for example, the practice football stadium at USC is only for the football team. The football money that comes in is only for the football program. That football program has huge expenses. They are giving out 85 full scholarships at the tune of $50,000 to $60,000 a year per athlete. They're having huge expenses on the equipment. They have huge expenses on an army of coaches and trainers and assistant coaches and what have you. Most of these programs, in fact, 60 to 65% of the programs of the top football programs are losing money. They are not making money. And then when you go to Division II and Division III, they are all practically losing money and being supported. So we keep them in place because we do believe that, yes, teamwork is important and the camaraderie and the lessons that you learn on the football field and so forth are great for life. And for some people, it works. But research has shown, and this is systematic research, we're not talking about individual observations, Because individual observations always show the exception to the rule. But research shows that athletes as a group are not necessarily doing worse or better than non-athletes in life, at work, or at school. But athletes are, as a group, somewhat more motivated to be there and work. But at the end of the day, they are doing just about the same. So you don't see really the added value in there. So when we're saying, oh, athletes are more aggressive, they are, if we want to say that they are more violent or they act more, they are involved in more acts of violence, no, that's not true. They are just about the same like the rest of the population. Mm-hmm. We don't see much of a difference. So the research does not show the added value. However, every single athlete that I had in every one of my classes over the past 25 years has told me from their personal experience that they feel that it gave them. So whether that is a placebo or it's true, I'll take them for their word. I mean, Right. The gentleman is entitled to his feelings, to the way how he sees the way it worked for him. I was an athlete, and I felt the same way. But when I'm looking at the research, we don't see really that sports is doing more than actually preparing you to play sports.
Yeah. I want to talk about injury for a moment here to make sure we hit on this before the hour is over. I would be very concerned, first of all, about any young person playing football who's even in middle school and younger than that. I have a concern about that sport anyhow because, as you said, there are so many injuries associated with it. But do you have any guidelines about, how often you should play, how old you should be, whether or not you should do different sports so you use different muscles? Because we've heard reports that a lot of young people are finding themselves having surgeries when they're still quite young.
Yes. Well, the sports, and especially specialized sports. So when children used to play freely on the court and play all positions, then they would not tax one area of the body more than another. But because of this craze into specializations and into early preparation, you can see already 5- and 6-year-olds being groomed to become a quarterback or to become a pitcher or to become a forward instead of just playing all positions and taking it easy. As a result, you get this increased wear and tear.
Right.
On certain body areas. And then you find out what we call little league elbow. And you find those injuries that are usually you don't see until somebody has gotten to adulthood and has played a sport for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So you see those injuries starting to appear earlier and earlier. And because of the level of competitiveness, because of the fact that you get stronger, faster, better kids out there, when there is a collision, when there is a contact, the contact is made at a higher velocity and with more power and force, and you are starting to get even worse injuries. And you're right. There, something needs to be done about it. But the problem is that in sports, you are trying to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
And to be the best, you are trying to do something better and higher and faster and longer and farther, and you constantly push the envelope. And what I see is I see the limits of the human body being reached, and now at this point what they are doing is they're trying to see, well, how can we stretch that out? And you can start seeing kids even before high school and in high school using steroids. Using all kinds of ergogenic aids.
I know.
And trying to cheat in those areas. I mean, we see that in the sports of baseball. We see that in the sports of cycling. We see that everywhere. And the fact that we haven't heard yet of anybody cheating in the Tour de France, it's probably because they're using something that is not detectable yet.
Yeah. Given
the history of the past 30 years, and I'm watching, I'm very avid follower of the Tour de France, and I'm a cyclist myself, amateur. But I would be surprised if they don't catch somebody cheating because the human body has its limits, and now they're pushing it further and further and further and doing better and better, and it comes at a cost.
Sure.
And they're pushing it down with the age. They're pushing it down with the training and the hard training and the more days and more hours, and they're pushing it with with ergogenic aids, bringing stuff from the outside into the body.
Let's go to Jane from Waukesha next. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Wow, this is really a great conversation. When I initially called in, I had a question for the guest on if he has found that this phenomenon with youth is, if he finds that there's any trends along any racial or socioeconomic status. My comment being that I am exposed to children of lower socioeconomic, inner city children that, I mean, they truly have these dreams of becoming professional athletes, and with at the expense of not wanting to focus on academics. Of course, everything is individual. There's certainly children that are very focused on their academics, and I'd just like the guest to comment on that.
I would think that you'd have to have a whole lot of money to really take care of fulfilling desires, and you have to come from upper-income families, probably. Am I wrong about that, Professor Frankel?
Well, in certain sports, you're absolutely right. But in the blue-collar sports, or in sports like track and field, so the blue-collar would be baseball, football, basketball. In track and field, it is more open and more available.
Mm.
But if somebody wants to play polo, or somebody wants to go swimming or gymnastics, or somebody wants to fence, in these instances, or play tennis, then you definitely need either money or you need a parent, like in the case of the Williams sisters with Serena and Venus. Their father coached them and brought them up to the level. Jennifer Capriati, her father coached her at the beginning until she became 13 and she could go and play as a professional and then ruin herself, unfortunately. But these are the exceptions. But basically, you're right. You need a lot of money for certain sports. You may need a little less money for other sports. But it seems that the high visibility of very successful minority athletes is pretty much blinding all of the kids that look up to them as role models, because they don't see as many examples of professors and pharmacists and physicians and engineers with such high profile. I mean, even though one of the greatest astrophysicists that we have in this country is African American, he doesn't have that much of visibility, like, say, Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. So this is what the kids see. They see that Michael Jordan is successful, and they want to be like him, or they want to be like some other guy who is a great athlete. And this is what they see, and it's a lot of fun to do the one thing that you like the most. It's not fun to do a whole bunch of other things that prepare you for life academically.
Right.
So obviously the kids are, unless somebody is there to tell them otherwise, and unless somebody is there to make sure that they do something else, if they don't have this kind of support from the family, if they don't have this kind of support from two parents, so it's not only an issue of race, it's also an issue of socioeconomics, and the race is tied in more with the socioeconomics than it is with the color of the skin.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment, and here's our number, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Daniel Frankel, Professor of School of Kinesiology and Nutritional Science at California State University in Los Angeles, and we'll be back with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We go to an email now. My husband and I were just talking about this problem. My son plays many different sports because I hope that he finds one that he loves and wants to play for the rest of his life. I want this for him because I have friends who love to golf or play basketball. These sports keep them in shape. When I was a child, I started playing basketball in middle school. Soccer and volleyball were introduced around this time. Now, if a child isn't playing soccer or basketball until middle school, he or she will be so far behind in skills that they will never make a team. Professor Frankel.
Yeah, this is a legitimate concern. And what happens is that we have several million kids playing soccer. from a relatively low number. So now I think we're over 6 million kids already in the United States are playing soccer. And the leagues are becoming more and more competitive. And it's a system that is pretty much filtering out all the kids that don't have the talent, the inborn talent, as one of our earlier caller, the former professional baseball player, mentioned. And he's right that people come to this world and they have certain talents in them, and you need to then nurture and build on those talents, because there's a lot of people that have the talent, and it's only those who have both the talent and the mental and physical stamina and the dedication and focus that can make it, as he did, that can actually make it through. But you do need to have the talent. So now what happens is that because there are so many kids and because the leagues are being so competitive, if a child comes from behind, he or she immediately finds themselves in a very bad position to try and catch up. And why is it so? It is so because, again, as our earlier caller mentioned, physical education is being phased out of education, unfortunately. And this is, I've written a whole article about that. It's titled, How About Some Muscle? McCoy was right, and it can be found on my website.
Okay.
And on my Acosta LA website, explaining what's happening with physical education and why is it. But kids are not getting taught some of the basic skills that they should. They're not even doing enough activity in the physical education program, so they get everything outside when they go to the clubs. Those kids that don't go to the clubs come with a big disadvantage. But if you are not in a club, if you are even in the league and even in the club, they're not interested in taking somebody who has no talent and can't contribute to the club.
Right.
And in the little league, you have a father coaching. It's not, I mean, Danny Franco is a certified soccer coach, and I've done it. So I can coach any kid and I can bring them up to speed. Mm-hmm. But most coaches are fathers and mothers, and they go in there and they volunteer and they're excited to teach, but they really don't know
right.
how to take all the kids and bring them up together to the same point. So the child that is a little more difficult, that can't do as well, is left behind, and mm-hmm. they can't catch up unless they can get help from somewhere. And so the concern is legitimate, that if a kid doesn't start early enough, but then the question comes, how early is early enough? And here we can say that probably for soccer, if a child starts at the age of 6 or 7 or 8 and more on an individual basis working on basic skills, it should be fine. Doesn't have to start competing at the age of 3 or 4 or 5. It's a team sport. You can never have a successful play date with 5 5-year-olds or 5 4-year-olds or 3-year-olds. I remember when my kids were young, the most we could handle is 1 play date. Now try to put a team of 3-year-olds trying to share 1 ball. I mean, right. This is ludicrous.
Right.
Anybody with a little common sense should be able to see that. And yet, when it comes to sports, people just don't see it.
No, they don't.
They don't get it.
Tina from Madison, hi.
Good morning. My experience is band, orchestra, and general music in Chicago, Milwaukee, and Madison inner-city schools. I don't teach anymore because they cut the arts. My biggest thing is I see a ton of minorities in the arts until middle school, and then it's almost all white, regardless of the demographics of the school. And I see a lot of young African-American boys who were extremely talented in poetry, song lyrics, strings, and all of a sudden by middle school they have that peer pressure that they have to play basketball, and the arts go out the window. I've seen this in 3 pretty good-sized cities, I'd say, so it's not something I read about. This is not vicarious to me. And I find it sad because, I mean, we are so pigeonholing students that, you know, they shouldn't play music or write poetry anymore because their friends are telling them that's not manly or whatever peer pressure. But here in Madison, they were actually starting the Wisconsin Academy of Science and Arts and Letters was looking at how all the middle school orchestras had almost all whites, but yet, when I taught 4th and 5th grade strings, it was sometimes 3/4 minority in my school, you know, proportionate to the demographic of the school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like a little comment on
sure.
that. I'll take
okay.
off here.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think that she is absolutely right. But this is a trend with our attitude toward what we call liberal education. And liberal education is an education of music, an education of poetry, an education of literature, an education of sports, an education of math and sciences and astronomy. But there is a trend to try and catch up with the sciences at the expense of some other very important areas of education. And I think that some of the people that have this business world mentality, which are in politics and in leadership positions and even in academia, are making the point that, yes, we can cut art, we can cut music, we can cut PE, but we can't cut math. But most people, believe it or not, never use calculus in their whole lifetime. And yet we all listen to music and we all enjoy art. So most people. So I'm not saying that math is not important. I never said because most of us never use calculus that we shouldn't teach calculus. I think calculus is very important. But so is art and so is music. And we need to put the money there and we need to put the talent there and we need to do it. It is depressing to hear that person and her story. It's depressing.
Sure it
but
is.
I see that also in the trends of sports. You can see lots of quarterbacks, and you can see lots of pitchers, and you can see lots of players in central positions who are minorities in the little leagues, and you can see them in high school. But by the time they get to college and professionals, they're nowhere to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's only recently that we finally had two African-American coaches coaching the two teams in the final Super Bowl game. It's only recently that we have seen a couple African Americans who are quarterbacks in football teams. So there is this kind of stacking and this kind of positioning and the removal of the minorities from the central positions is true across the board, both in academia, in the arts, and in sports. And we've seen that in sports, it's documented.
Let's go to Michael from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I have three comments. I'll try to keep them brief. The first is, in the 50s, I was a graduate student in chemistry at Northwestern University. And the best I could do in a scholarship, despite excellent grades, was 50%. However, I taught a jock course in Roman literature to the athletes, and it was a 33-page pamphlet that they had a year to learn. It was ridiculous. The second comment is I have a granddaughter now who was second in her class in a class of 900 in a high-class high school. She applied to Harvard and was rejected. The only admission to Harvard in her graduating year was a girl with a tennis scholarship. Third thing I have to say is I am now an anesthesiologist, and I practice in a clinic that does exclusively sports medicine. Our clinic practically runs on injuries sustained by teens and preteens in athletics, and it ranges all the way from shoulder separations to anterior cruciate ligament blowouts of the knee, elbow fractures, and the worst of all, multiple football cerebral concussions. I believe in the mens sana and corpora sana, a healthy mind and a healthy body, but I think all you have to do for that is to walk a couple of miles a day. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. You agree with that? What you need for a healthy mind and body is to walk a couple miles a day?
I totally agree. In fact, even jogging is not as good as walking, as we find out. And yeah, a couple miles a day would be great. I'm so grateful that his call came through because I feel to a certain extent a little bit vindicated here. He's absolutely right. We put a lot of emphasis on athletics and sometimes at the expense of other areas. And I'm not saying that athletics is not important. I mean, this is my business. This is my love. I love athletics.
Sure.
I was an athlete. I competed in many sports. So I have nothing against athletics. I just want to put it in the right perspective. Mm-hmm. And the injuries that athletics are causing are caused because of the level of competition. Mm-hmm. Because the level of competition is so high and so fierce that it is already beyond health. It is sports-related type of fitness that one gets, which is not what we call the health-related fitness.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much. Professor David Frankel, our guest this hour, professor in the School of Kinesiology and Nutritional Science at California State University in Los Angeles. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour and to Rachel Biblow for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. We'll be with you again on Monday, All Things Political at 9. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.